Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith, and hope. Discover more interviews at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Well, let's get to those reasons then for traditional marriage being the form of marriage that we should stay with in Australia, in our view. I thought we should go to someone who can give us both the history and also the religious history and the theology of the question. That person being John Dixon. John Dixon is the founding director of the Centre for Public Christianity, who just happened to have a fairly significant birthday this weekend. John Dixon, welcome back to Open House, and happy birthday for yesterday.
Thank you so much. It's always good to talk with you.
Thank you. John, marriage and the state, interesting combination. You've got a period of history where at some point the state embraces what has been a cultural institution. As an historian, talk to me about that.
Well, it's mixed because it is right that the state got involved more recently in the last few centuries in affirming marriage and registering marriage and so on. But for most of the medieval period, marriages were registered in the churches. They were the ones doing the marriages. But that's partly because churches were houses of law in the whole medieval period, where what the canon jurists, that is the canon lawyers, said ought to be the case, really was listened to even by monarchs. So it's not exactly true to say the state only recently in the last few hundred years stepped into marriage, because the way the state looked after marriage was to allow the churches to look after marriage, because indeed they also looked after civil disputes, the rights of the poor, and so on. The other interesting thing to throw into the mix is actually marriage was regulated and registered back in ancient Roman times. The emperors had a very clear interest in marriage, and they did release all sorts of laws promoting marriage, making divorce more difficult, punishing people for committing adultery. And this is because the Romans had worked out that this little institution might be the thing that creates cohesion in the empire more than pretty much anything else.
And so what was the ancient Roman view of marriage? Was marriage between a man and a woman in the ancient world?
Oh, uniformly and universally. Yes, the view of marriage was the same in Egyptian, Babylonian, Greek, and Roman ancient societies. Their view was it was between a man and a woman. And anyone who knows their history knows this. This wasn't because they were homophobic. Greece and Rome were perfectly okay with same-sex love and enduring same-sex relationships. We have plenty of documentation about that. In fact, one whole book was written by Plutarch, one of the great moralists, arguing back and forth, trying to work out which is the purest form of love, same-sex love or heterosexual love. So it was a topic for debate. But the thing is, even though they were perfectly fine with the nobility of same-sex relationships as they saw it, they did not countenance same-sex marriage.
And why not? What was the difference?
They had worked out what pretty much every culture had worked out. There is something fundamentally different about a man and a woman that bond together. They had worked out that there is only one human bond that nature itself had given the power to come together in hope of creating and nurturing their own children. They knew there was no other way to do that. And so they reserved a special accolade, a special title for a unique form of human bond. That is, when a man and a woman decide to bond together, they are bonding for each other, but also for creating new others that they will then raise as their shared own.
So, John, when Jesus goes to that wedding at Cana in Galilee, and with the other references to marriage in the Bible, it's just assumed that that's part of the culture. The culture in which it's being written is a culture in which marriage means one thing, that is, a marriage, a union between a man and a woman.
Yes, absolutely. In Jewish culture, Roman culture, Greek culture, they all had the same view of marriage. But so did the ancient Chinese, you know, and the ancient Arabians.
The point being that there's no need to spell out, that there's no need to say, it's not a deficit to say the Bible doesn't, you know, set out chapter and verse a particular form of marriage, because that's what marriage was, that is the definition.
Well, except that the Bible does lay out its view. So in Genesis 2, you get a very clear reference to God's creation of Adam and Eve, and that the different sexes are actually different because they come together in a perfect whole. The two shall become one. Jesus cites that passage in Matthew 19, and he says, from the beginning God made them male and female, and for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife. So Jesus actually thinks the very reason of marriage is the dual sexes that is built into creation. But actually, you know, that isn't just a religious view. It's the view the Romans had, it's the view the Greeks had, just by looking at nature and working out there's a very unique thing that happens when a man and a woman bond for life. They create and nurture their own children. And so let's call that thing a special title, marriage. And nothing else can be marriage on that view. Even though you can honor any form of loving relationship,
yes,
that's no criticism of any other form of relationship. To say that actually marriage is a unique thing, it needs its own unique label. And if one believes that a profound social good is ensured by preserving this view of marriage, if one believes that making sure that new human beings are raised by the two people that gave them life, if that's a good thing, if you're on board with that, then you're halfway toward thinking, actually, we should reserve the title marriage for the only relationship in nature that is inherently oriented toward that. And I say inherently because, of course, there are some couples who end up not being able to have kids.
Well, yes. So now let's deal with those hard cases, because this is where the argument starts to become complex in our 21st century world of technology and also imperfection. So many married couples, heterosexual couples, can't have children. That's point one. Number two, children are not safe, it has to be said, in some relationships, in some family situations, heterosexual or otherwise. And point three, I suppose it's now possible for technology to intervene so that while you still need two different cell types, you can do it in a test tube. And so we can now create life outside of the unique physical act between a man and a woman. So does any of that change the special nature of what Jesus tells us God has ordained?
I can't see how. It's true that we can create new human beings in a test tube, and thank God for that, you know, technology. But it's still one man and one woman involved in that creation. And that child is still going to grow up with longing to know the biological parents. And marriage is the only way to ensure that that is given its best chance. As for couples not being able to have kids, the Romans knew that. The Greeks knew that. But they saw it as a kind of a tragedy. You know, they might have blamed the gods or something like that. But they didn't stop calling those relationships marriages, because they looked at the man and woman who couldn't have children as, you might say, injured members of the same team. You don't kick them out of the team because they're injured. Sure, they're not able to, not in practice able to strive for the same goal, but they actually are the very kind of human bond that in normal circumstances nature has blessed with the power to come together in hope of creating and nurturing your own children. So they are to be called marriages precisely because they are the kind of relationship that is oriented toward this great good. Whereas other forms of relationships, whether it's two cohabiting best friends or two people of the same sex, are not the kind of relationship that inherently, structurally, in any way is oriented toward creating and nurturing your own children. It's just impossible. And so it's not about denigrating those forms of love and friendship.
Well, now, there's the problem. You can hear what we've just discussed very clearly, if you're of a mind to hear it, as a denigration. We're second best, as Penny Wong said, I love my children, as if there was a question as to whether she did or didn't. I don't think that's what was being said. I hope it wasn't what was being said. But how do we deal with that problem in this debate without being judgmental and in a pastoral, caring way, but without throwing out the basic belief?
Well, of course, we would need to affirm that Penny Wong and her partner are doing a beautiful thing in giving care to human beings. And so this just no way that should be denigrated in any way. The question, though, is it the kind of relationship that inherently, naturally, structurally produces its own children? And the answer is obviously no. I mean, you could take a household of five people who are looking after children. Do we call that household married simply because they are looking after children? I can't see any logical way to get my head around thinking of that as marriage. And it's the same with a same-sex couple. Sure, they can look after children really well. Their children are going to grow up God willing, in a loving household. I mean, it can go badly just as easily as any relationship can go badly.
Yes.
It's not a case of saying that the children are going to be damaged by this. I don't buy that kind of line one often hears. For me, it's far more a matter of logic.
Yes.
If we think it's a good thing for children to be created and nurtured by the two people and only two people that are responsible for their life, for giving life,
yes,
then there's only one relationship that is structurally pointing toward that, striving toward that, and that is a male and female who bond in hope of creating new human beings.
Well, John Dixon, are you concerned as not just the head of the CPX, Centre for Public Christianity, but also as a minister of religion, a pastor, a theologian, are you concerned about what happens next? However it ends up, and whichever way the legislation eventually goes, however the plebiscite turns out, is it diminishing the nature of our society, or the well-being in our society generally, that we're basically going hammer and tongs on this issue?
I'm concerned about a bunch of things. One is, how well are we going to conduct the debate over the coming months? That really does trouble me. I think on balance, I was pretty much in favour of a full plebiscite, you know, a compulsory plebiscite, yeah, for the whole nation, because that would have moral authority, whichever way it went. I'm less comfortable with the postal plebiscite, because I think we'll get a very low turnout. You know, Australians will put up with something compulsory, but if they don't have to vote on something, they may well not. And so what that will do, if there's a very low turnout, it will diminish the authority of the democratic will of the people. So let's just say the same-sex marriage side lose in a postal plebiscite. I'm sure what their argument will be is that if only 10% of Australians voted, obviously the churches used their power to rally their people,
yeah,
and they overturned the vote. But if it goes the other way, if same-sex marriage wins through a postal vote, I can imagine Christians saying, oh, it was unfair, the Australian marriage equality, yes, pulled out there, you know, and get up, got out there.
No, I completely agree with you, the way that this has been managed. And I think you'd have to say that it's funny now for the Labor Party to be going all out, saying enroll to vote, encouraging people to vote, which, by the way, I agree with. It's funny because they had it in their power to give it the authority of a full plebiscite and voted twice against that. But anyway, that's political process.
I understand, you know, the motive of someone who says, I'm against the plebiscite because I think LGBTI people will be harmed. I get that. If I believed that we couldn't, as Australians, conduct a good debate, I'd be against the plebiscite. I really would.
Yes.
Because it's just not worth harming. It's just that I don't share that assumption. I think Australians can step up, and as heated as the debate might get, I don't think we're going to harm LGBTI people. So that's why I can think on that assumption, a plebiscite's probably a good thing. I wish it were a compulsory one. It's a postal one. Then there's the question you asked about, am I concerned about where this might go? You know, yes and no. I do think that same-sex marriage is a massive departure from classical marriage, because as soon as you say we can define marriage now simply as a bond of love between adults, actually there's no reason not to have all sorts of marriage, including polyamorous marriage. I don't mean polygamy, where a man has three wives. I mean polyamory, where, say, one bisexual woman can have a male lover and a female lover, and they're all in one marriage. And there are polyamorous groups that want marriage recognition next, after same-sex marriage goes through. And this is not a slippery slope argument. People say, oh, that's a slippery slope argument. No, it's just a completely logical argument. If marriage is no longer defined the way the Chinese, the Greeks, the Romans, the Christians, the Jews have defined marriage, as the one human bond under heaven uniquely gifted to come together in hope of creating children and raising them. If we move away from that, there's actually no definition of marriage anymore other than an adult human bond. And there can be many things that are adult human bonds. And I think any diminishing of the value a culture puts on making sure kids are raised by the two people that gave them life, any diminishing of that, I don't think is good for society. But then again, I come from that generation that remembers, you know, that people used to think having sex before marriage is wrong.
Right. That's right.
And that's now completely out of step. And my view of that is I still think having sex before marriage is not just, you know, wrong from a Christian point of view, but illogical, given what sex is obviously for. It's damaging. It diminishes sex. It diminishes human beings. But I'm not grumpy about it. You know, I don't walk around criticizing people. I just think it's another way in which our culture has walked away from really intellectually and pastorally significant truths.
Yes.
And I just get on with life. And if same-sex marriage goes through, I'm really not going to be one of those grumpy Christians howling at the wind.
But we can't be. I mean, we just cannot allow this to prevent us from reaching out in grace and love to the people around us, even though as you enter a new decade of your life. I'm not going to say how old you turned this week, but anyway, as you enter a new decade, a decade that I'm in, you look back and you go, well, stuff has changed, culture has changed, but God still loves people and I still want to tell them. So my final question to you, John Dixon, is this. As a minister of religion, I imagine you've had people, same-sex couples, coming to you already asking if you would marry them. That's just a guess. But if the law changes, even though you'll have protection, assuming the bill goes through as it's, you know, been proposed, assuming you'll have protection as a minister of religion against being able to say to that same-sex couple, no, I can't marry you. But nevertheless, let's say they're in your church. Like, I'm quite sure you don't turn away same-sex couples from your church. So they'll say to you, well, yes, but we're good enough to be in your church week after week and sit under your teaching, but you won't marry us? Now, just walk me through that dilemma.
Yeah, it's going to be a dilemma, but it's one I feel very comfortable about, because so long as I can show pastoral care to any LGBTI person in my congregation, assure them of my love and of God's love, and call them to the life Christ would have of them, then they are in the same situation as every other person in the church who I'm also trying to love and pastor and call to live by the way of Christ. I won't be able to marry them because I'll have to explain to them I don't think it's possible, even logically possible, to call a same-sex relationship marriage, because the classical view is that marriage is a unique accolade for the unique human bond that nature has gifted with the power to come together in hope of creating and nurturing children. And because they can't do that, that seems to me illogical to call it marriage, even though I can, you know, show them care and so on. Now, if they leave the church, if they think I'm a meanie, you know, a bigot, I will sadly wear that, because I'm absolutely committed to losing well. And I really hope that, you know, if the plebiscite goes to approve same-sex marriage and the parliament then votes that way, Christians will lose really well, because that was our specialty from the beginning.
Oh, I hope so.
Jesus on the cross,
yes,
said, "Father, forgive them." That should be our spirit.
And I hope that if it goes the other way, we win well. It's not even a win and lose, is it? But I hear what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, many people think Christians are idiots on this now.
Yes, they do.
And that causes some Christians to wobble in their view. But I would just say, hey, Christians have always been seen as idiots. We've got it so easy now compared to the Christians in, say, the mid-60s in Rome, the mid-AD 60s in Rome. I mean, that was real pressure. They were considered complete idiots. But they just knew that went with the territory. If you believe you've stumbled across an eternal truth for all cultures through all time, then your view is going to be out of step with every culture at some point, because culture changes, truth doesn't. Just live with it, and live with it with grace.
Beautiful. Well, John, we're very excited about the new CPX production that you're working on. Quickly, when do you think it's going to be released?
For the love of God, how the church is better and worse than you ever imagined. It's we're God willing, March. It'll be out. It'll be in cinemas. It'll be broadcast. There'll be a website. God willing, Netflix. We're trying to get it on every available platform.
Amazing.
But hopefully, it's going to be something that will instruct people and answer the question: has Christianity done more harm than good through Western history?
Wonderful, John. Thanks for what you do. Thanks for speaking with us tonight on Open House.
Absolute pleasure, Stephen.
John Dixon, the founding director of the Centre for Public Christianity. He's also an Anglican minister in a church on Sydney's North Shore. And he's a theologian. He's a very, very good thinker and an expert in ancient history. So the ideal person, we thought, to bring you that perspective tonight on the history of the theology. And, a lot about creating civil society as well. And it is indeed our hope here on Open House that the debate is characterised by love and grace on both sides. And that it's not a matter of winning and losing, but I do like John's phrase, winning well, losing well. I think what happens next is almost more important, certainly as important as what happens in the vote itself, because this is our society. We need to live together and continue to live together. And that, by the way, is one of the reasons that I think that the protections that they have talked about so far, the religious freedom protections, are woefully inadequate.